This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will visit with Dr. Bo Kilmer. He is co-director of the RAND Corporation's Drug Policy Research Center and co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. With other states having marijuana legalized, is Louisiana going to follow the other states? We'll find out from Bo Kilmer his thoughts on whether this is a movement that has legs in our country. Also, Dorothy Cotton, civil rights pioneer. She was part of the 1963 Birmingham bus boycott. And she accompanied Dr. Martin Luther King to Norway in 1964 when Dr. King received the Nobel Peace Prize. Dorothy Cotton's in Baton Rouge, and we'll talk with her about her long career in civil rights. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Do want to note that tonight at the old Governor's Mansion, there will be an event, a forum involving Jan Moeller and Robert Travis Scott, both of whom worked at the Times-Picayune together. Now they're in active involvement in prominent think tanks in our community, with Robert Travis Scott now the head of the Public Affairs Research Council, and Jan Moeller also active in defining the issues that we are facing each day. And they will be joined by Joel Robideau, chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. And it'll be Politics and Pino tonight at the Old Governor's Mansion, starting at 6 o'clock, with the actual forum beginning at 7 p.m. So if you can make it, we look forward to your participation at no charge tonight. And if you are coming, please contact Latricia Houston at WRKF 225-926-3050 or latricia@wrkf.org. We do need to know if you're going to be there so we can have a head count, but it would be nice to see as many people as possible tonight at the old Governor's Mansion. And we do want to note the passing of Huell Perkins, longtime administrator at LSU and Southern University, one of the giants of this community for decades. He died 2 days ago at the age of 88. 88 years well lived for Dr. Huell Perkins, who's a guest on this show. And I don't know of anybody who ever met the man who didn't like him. And he was a towering intellect, a great musician, and an exceptional man who graced this community with his presence for 88 years. 297-5633 is your number. Dr. Bo Kilmer is our leadoff guest, co-director of the RAND Corporation's Drug Policy Research Center, and co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Good morning, Dr. Kilmer.
Jim, thanks very much for having me.
What is your belief regarding what we don't know about marijuana that we need to know?
There's a lot that we don't know. You know, what happened in Colorado and Washington in November was really unprecedented. Before that, no modern jurisdiction had ever removed the prohibition on commercial production and distribution of marijuana and for marijuana for non-medical purposes. So we really are in a world that we've never seen. You know, a lot of people think that marijuana was legalized in the Netherlands, but that's not the case. You know, yeah, if you're in the Netherlands and you're over 18, you know, you can walk into those coffee shops and buy up to 5 grams because they have an official policy of not enforcing the law against small transactions. You can kind of think about it being legal in the front door of these coffee shops. However, it's still illegal to grow and sell marijuana to those coffee shops. It's prohibited. So it's actually illegal in the back door.
So
the idea of having for-profit companies come in and produce marijuana is really revolutionary.
What are you advocating? Are you advocating total legalization? Commerce?
Oh, no. Oh, so stepping back a little bit, so RAND is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization that is dedicated to providing information to, you know, public officials and to other decision makers. And, you know, we don't have an official policy about marijuana legalization. So our goal really is to kind of present the information so those individuals that are participating in these discussions can be informed.
It does appear, though, in the process of presenting the information, Dr. Kilmer, that you would not be averse to some kind of marijuana legalization.
No, it's, I mean, so RAND doesn't have this official policy, but that said, I mean, I've been, you know, publishing on this topic for more than 10 years, so definitely, I mean, I have some of my own personal opinions and sort of my colleagues, but what's important is that kind of personal opinions in this matter, you know, really shouldn't play a part. You know, as an analyst, my job is to kind of present the information and help people understand, hey, here's some areas where we don't have good information, and this is where the research needs to go.
Well, in a few states, as we know, Colorado and Washington in particular, they have legalized the recreational use of marijuana. Their voters decided to do so. Do you think this will be a sweeping change? I think we have 10 states with pending legislation. So where are we going with this?
It's a great question. In November, the voters in Colorado and Washington passed their initiative to allow for-profit companies to come in. And, you know, there are discussions about other ballot initiatives appearing in other states. And, yes, other state legislatures, different politicians are introducing legislation to also legalize the production and distribution. But what also you have to keep in mind is that while these states are passing these laws or are considering them, this is all still illegal under federal law. So and so far, the federal government or the different federal agencies have not come out and made a statement about what they plan to do in Washington and in Colorado. So a lot remains to be seen. But while there is this uncertainty, you know, there are decision makers in these states that now are grappling with these questions that have never been addressed. You know, how do we regulate it? What type of labels do we put on this? Who can buy? What can be sold in stores? So there are a lot of kind of really tough questions that that the policymakers are confronting in these states.
297-5633, if you'd like to join Dr. Bo Kilmer. He is co-director of the RAND Corporation's Drug Policy Research Center, and he's been following marijuana legalization issues for 10 years, he says. And currently, there are 10 states with pending legislation to legalize medical marijuana. And the 10 include some very red states. They are Alabama, Florida, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Missouri, New Hampshire, New York, and West Virginia. 4 states have pending legislation favorable towards medical marijuana but would not legalize its use, and those are Maryland, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Texas. So do you think something like this would fly in the Deep South? I see Alabama on the list. I think Alabama's already had a vote on this once, and it failed, as it did in Mississippi. But is the tide turning?
Yeah. Well, there's an important distinction needs to be made between medical marijuana and then legalizing marijuana for non-medical purposes. So right now there are 18 or 19 states which have allowances for medical marijuana, and it's interesting in those those different jurisdictions there are a lot of different approaches. I mean, some places like California and Colorado, they we have these dispensaries where people who have these recommendations can walk in and buy them, and those those dispensaries get a lot of attention, and they often sometimes get raided by the DEA. But it's important to note that that's not the case in all states. Not all states that have medical marijuana have these dispensaries. So there's a lot of variation there. I mean, in some places, they just allow people to grow at home. But what happened in Colorado and Washington was very different in that the laws were passed to allow for-profit companies to come in and produce for the non-medical market. So, right now in those two states, if you're 21 and older and you're not on federal land, you can anyone can possess up to an ounce. You can't buy it in stores mm-hmm. yet. So there's a difference between kind of what's happening in those two states, and and the medical marijuana initiatives or bills that are being considered in other places. But
what would happen, Bo, let's say, to the prison system in the United States if suddenly marijuana were legalized? Would we have fewer people in jail?
You would, but it wouldn't make as big of an impact as you might hear on the news. I mean, essentially, if you look at everyone who's incarcerated for drug offenses, about less than 10% of them are there for marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those folks that are there for marijuana also had, you know, concurrent charges. I mean, so that said, yeah, you would see fewer arrests. You'd have fewer people kind of going through the criminal justice system, fewer people ending up in jail, fewer people ending up in prison. Rand did a study looking at this in California. And kind of before we did our study, we were reviewing the literature on this, trying to figure out, well, how much do the California taxpayers spend enforcing laws, against marijuana? And when we did our review of the literature, that we found two studies. One study said that California spends about $200 million a year enforcing marijuana laws. The other study put it at $2 billion. That's a really big difference,
the
extra zero there. And, so we kind of looked into this, and it's not, for this particular piece, it's not rocket science. You know, give me the number of people that were arrested, information about adjudication, number of people in prison, slap on some unit costs, and I can get you a good ballpark figure. And the figure we ended up coming up with was much closer to the 200 million mark.
All right.
You
have written that the underground economy for marijuana in this country is estimated somewhere between $15 billion and $30 billion annually. And what happens to this if it's legalized at some point?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that depends if we're talking about state-level legalization or if you're talking about national legalization. Because with national legalization, you would actually be able to, if that happened, you could actually probably have this, have the marijuana farmed on, industrial plots. And so it could be farmed like any other agricultural commodity. And so, then at that point, there wouldn't be much need for importing anything from Canada or from Mexico. When these states are legalizing, I mean, that's one of the tough decisions that the policymakers need to address is, well, what type of production do you allow? Do you allow it to only be grown indoors, maybe only in people's backyards? I mean, those decisions are, it's interesting. The decisions you make about production are really going to influence the cost and ultimately the prices that people pay. And so and that will determine whether or not they kind of, in-state production, can account for the entire market, or if there still will be a need for imports. Rand has done some research looking at how much money the Mexican drug trafficking organizations earn by moving marijuana from Mexico to the United States. And our best estimate, and this was a couple years ago, and I know the numbers have changed, but our best estimate was that the drug trafficking organizations probably earn about $2 billion a year moving marijuana across the border. One could imagine that if you were in a situation where you had national legalization and all of the marijuana that was consumed was produced in the United States, those Mexican drug trafficking organizations would be out at least $2 billion.
Well, there's a potential tax base here, too, that is substantial. I would think local and maybe even the federal government, they'd be salivating at getting taxes off marijuana consumption and production and sales.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And how it all plays out with respect to revenues is, a lot of it's going to depend on what happens, the type of production that's allowed. And one of the issues you have to keep in mind is if marijuana production is legal and the production costs drop dramatically, you have to be concerned. Or you have to keep in mind that if you place a tax, if the tax is too large, on the marijuana, then he would still have the black market.
We'll be back with Bo Kilmer after this brief timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. In a few minutes, we'll hear from civil rights pioneer Dorothy Cotton, who was at Louisiana State University for several events, but she is in our studio in the next few minutes to talk about her remarkable life and times. And we rejoin Dr. Bo Kilmer, joining us from California, co-director of the RAND Corporation's Drug Policy Research Center, and the author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Now, Dr. Kilmer, there are those who believe that marijuana, if it were legalized, would curtail the use of alcohol, which may be an even bigger issue when it comes to drinking and driving. But what do your studies show as far as marijuana use and alcohol consumption? Does one actually reduce the other, or do they complement one another? What have you found?
Jim, I mean, that is the question. And right now, the evidence base we have about whether or not marijuana and alcohol are substitutes or complements first of all, it's really small and it's not conclusive. So we don't have good information about whether or not, you know, if marijuana use goes up, whether or not alcohol use will go down or potentially go up. But even if we did have a good idea about that relationship, it's not entirely clear that we could just take that research and then apply it to the world where marijuana is legal. A lot's going to depend on, you know, as I said before, on the price of marijuana, whether or not advertising is allowed. So I really do hope that, as things progress in Colorado and Washington, I hope that researchers pay really close attention to this, this question.
Well, when you and I were growing up, we were told that marijuana was a gateway drug. Is there any evidence to that effect?
Oh, Jim, we could talk 45 minutes just about that question. it's tough. I mean, this is kind of very much a complicated literature. So if somebody says, hey, there's absolutely no evidence of the gateway effect, or someone says, oh, I've got, you know, the studies are really conclusive about this, you should be skeptical. You know, there have been some good studies done which have shown that the individuals who use marijuana were more likely to use other substances in the future. But the issue with those studies is you always wonder, are they accounting for everything? Could it be that it wasn't the marijuana, but it was kind of poor parenting that led them to hang out with the wrong peers? And they were hanging out with the wrong peer group, and that's what led to the marijuana and the cocaine use. So that's one of the issues that always kind of comes up with those studies. Similarly, some of my colleagues at RAND have done some work and, you know, kind of looking at the gateway and found that, if you kind of look at the data that people are using, there are these alternative explanations. One piece of this is, and this is actually something that was part of the decision in the Netherlands, you know, 25 years ago, or more than that, almost 40 years ago. You know, as we talked about before, the Netherlands, they have the coffee shops where you can walk in there and buy marijuana. And one of the reasons they did that is they wanted to create a separate market. They didn't want people buying marijuana from individuals that could be selling them heroin or cocaine. So they tried to separate the market. So it'll be really interesting to kind of see how this all plays out with respect to, to legal marijuana and where it's sold and how it's used. But I think if you're in the grand scheme of things, you should be much more concerned about this alcohol issue in terms of whether or not there's substitutes or complements. I think that's going to have more of an impact kind of on society than this gateway drug argument.
Well, we certainly don't mean, or we don't appear to be leaning toward any kind of prohibition of alcohol. If anything, it's more available. Bars are open longer. What do you anticipate as far as any kind of movement to curtail the use of alcohol?
Yeah, well, this is actually the alcohol industry. provides a good example or something that people should pay attention to if you're participating in these marijuana legalization debates. I mean, what's happened with the alcohol industry is, you know, most of the alcohol that's consumed is consumed by heavy users. And so the alcohol companies, they make most of their money off of those individuals who are probably using too much. And, you know, that there's a profit motive for that. And the alcohol companies have strong lobbies. And what they've done is kind of over time, they've made it hard to raise the tax on alcohol. I mean, if you kind of look at the public health literature, it's very clear that society would be much better off at on a number of different, you know, on a number of different levels if we could just increase the alcohol tax. But the industry fights hard against that. And so as you're thinking about, well, what does a world with marijuana legalization look like? You have to think about whether or not for-profit companies are going to be allowed and whether or not they're going to be able to amass this type of kind of political power. So that's something that these, you know, that policymakers in these states are going to have to keep in mind, because once you have an industry there, they oftentimes try to fight regulations and fight taxes.
297-5633 is your number in our remaining time with Dr. Bo Kilmer of the RAND Institute. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Kilmer.
Good morning. Dr. Kilmer, given the studies that show that marijuana is less harmful than alcohol and tobacco, is the resistance to legalization because right-wingers associate it with, what, long-haired anti-Vietnam or, you know, progressive thinking in general?
So that's a great question. And, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why some people, you know, want to legalize marijuana, and there are a lot of reasons why some people want to keep it prohibited. I'm sure some of it has to do with kind of perceptions. You know, there are also some individuals that they're just morally opposed to intoxication, and so they're not going to vote for legalization, and they're not supportive of this. It's really complex in terms of kind of the different arguments that are being used. And one of the other concerns is that people are worried about there being this other new industry like the alcohol and tobacco industries. You know, and they're kind of worried about that because those kind of businesses and made a fair amount of money, you know, trying to target young users and trying to get them using their products. And so I think that's another reason why there's a lot of resistance. But like you said, there are a lot of people that support that, you know, that do want to legalize marijuana. They believe it's safer than alcohol, and they want to get tax revenue from it. But kind of stepping back, I mean, you know, to me, this is one of these topics where I think reasonable people can disagree on this. But the idea is to, you know, to have a discussion, and kind of over the past four or five years, you're starting to see a serious discussion about this, and it's beginning to move away from the abstract notions, and you're really starting to see people talk about the specifics. Because, you know, as I said earlier in the show, you know, the decisions that you make about production and taxation and regulation, that's really, going to shape how this all plays out and whether or not this ends up being a good thing for society or a bad thing.
Well, Dr. Bo Kilmer, we thank you. Certainly we look forward to talking with you again. And the book that you have written, it is forthcoming, isn't it?
No, it's actually in stores now.
Okay, Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. So that's the book. This is the man, and of course the RAND Institute does many other studies, and we look forward to talking with Bo again. Thank you, Bo.
Thank you very much, Jim. Take care.
Appreciate it. We're joined in studio now by Dr. Dorothy Cotton, so we're going from marijuana to cotton. And she is a civil rights legend who will be at LSU the next few days discussing her battle and the implications for racial equality in contemporary society. Tomorrow, Dorothy will be joined by some other people. We'll talk about them as well, 9 to 11 and 2 to 4:30 at the Holiday Forum in the Journalism Building on the LSU campus. And tonight there will be a reception and keynote address from Dr. Cotton, a National Freedom Award recipient, author, and confidant of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Good morning, Dr. Dorothy.
Good morning.
And when I say a confidant of Dr. King, you were a very close friend of his, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I'd like to talk about that, too, that we, a number of us, hung around with him every single day, went everywhere with him. And the reason I like to talk about that is that people almost make him a non-person.
Well, I look at you, and you're vibrant and beautiful and full of vim and vigor, and you are the same age as Dr. King. I think he's a year older, but he could still be around. That's the remarkable thing. He's been dead for 45 years.
Yes, of course. Right. I don't talk about age very much because, and especially as related to women, we do some interesting things when we think about and focus on the age of a woman, but that doesn't seem to happen when we talk about the age of a man. They can be vibrant and giving and working and contributing.
Men just get old, right?
Well, do they?
Well,
you tell
we
me.
We don't live as long as women, and we break down a lot easier than women do.
Oh,
women have
so?
Great resilience. There's no doubt about it. Hats off to you. You're still going strong, but you were in 1964, and that's, what, 49 years ago, on the trip to Norway when Dr. King received the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes.
What was that experience like?
Fabulous experience. I, of course, as a younger person, never just envisioned that I could have that kind of experience. Well, by the time we were on our way to Oslo to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, I had certainly at that time gotten used to hanging around with this man who was leading a movement that actually, I say, changed, helped us change America, because he didn't do that by himself. He didn't even start it. Mm-hmm. And but going to Oslo, Norway is just a memorable experience. And I have some things to say about that, which I wrote about in my book that's just out 2 or 3 months, which title, incidentally, I got from a speech that he made in closing one of my workshops. But going to Oslo was a memorable experience. I can talk about some details of what happened once we got there, if you're interested.
Sure, certainly.
In that.
Certainly. What happened in Oslo?
Well, I remember we all, of course, made special effort to be dressed in our finest, and we had several days at in which we could just be in the hotel and even have some programs on our own designed just to have our group hanging out together mm-hmm. and doing some things. And one night it was sort of like a talent show, and everybody, all of our group were gathered in uh-huh. a room and with microphones. And I noticed that we were getting a little bit late because we had a scheduled place to be in a few minutes at one point. And I was touching people on the shoulder saying, you know, you got to cut your part short here because it's time for us to move along. And somebody fairly hit me on the arm and wanted me to stop urging people to move. And the reason was they wanted me to look over at Daddy King. And everybody called Dr. King's father Daddy King. And Daddy King was sitting there crying. That's a moment I will never forget. His son is there to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And my trying to get people to move was not important. And what happened was Daddy King raised his glass, and he was not a drinking man, but as far as I knew, but he raised his glass and said, when I responded to this mm-hmm. tugging at my sleeve to shut up, and said, look at Daddy King, look at Daddy King. He's crying. His son is receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. And what he said was, I want you to raise your glasses of wine with me because I really feel that I must make a toast to God. That's fairly not quite comical because he was in tears. He was so moved. But of course, we were all really, really joyful. And I don't know if you want other details
But that came on the heels of 1963, 50 years ago, which was the year for the civil rights movement. And you were right there. I suppose you were there when Dr. King delivered his I Have a Dream speech?
Of course. Oh,
August 28th, 1963.
I helped to, type the last draft of that speech, the I Have a Dream speech, yes.
You typed the last draft?
Yes, that he actually used. But, of course, many people know now that Dr. King didn't stick to a manuscript, even though he had one in front of him. He really was I call him a poet because when he put the manuscript down, he was always even at his best. But he could come out of a meeting with not having a planned manuscript and make, he did indeed make some of the best speeches and wonderful statements that he is known to have made. He was just really good. He had great recall. So he could quote theologians and philosophers and positive change agents coming from playing badminton. And I can talk about hanging out with him when he would fool around with us, like with singing even together.
We're talking with Dorothy Foreman Cotton, recognized as the highest-ranking woman in the SCLC during the midst of the 1960s. She served as director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference Citizen Education Program at the peak of the Civil Rights Movement, a position that situated her in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s inner circle of executive staff. What happened?
I'm glad you mentioned that, the Citizenship Education Program.
What happened in Birmingham and in Montgomery?
Well, it's what happened in a lot of places. I'm interested in helping to make clearer what we mean when we say movement, because I think it's much larger and has much fuller meaning than I think that most people are conscious of when they talk about, you know, the movement. Because people all over, not just Birmingham and Montgomery, people were starting, African-American people and white allies, people were starting to protest our what I call American-style apartheid. And I can think, for example, certainly that was Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth in Birmingham, and who decided he was going to take his children to the Supreme Court said separate and equal is inherently unequal. And he took his children to the white school. They bombed his house, and Dr. King didn't tell him to do that. That's another thing I really like to emphasize, because people were being active and protesting this system, again, American-style apartheid, all over the place. There was Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi, who decided she was going to give her energy, an eighth-grade graduate, give her energy to fighting for the right of African-American folk to register to vote. There were just, we used to sing a song, "The Spirit is Moving All Over the Land," and it was. So I hold a vision of protest activity emerging and evolving in a lot of places, though we highlight Birmingham got probably the most notoriety. The cameras were there, the newspapers were there, much more than they were in the Delta of Mississippi, as where Fannie Lou Hamer, for example, was. But when Dr. King didn't tell Rosa Parks not to go to the back of the bus in Montgomery, she decided that on her own. And I think that's really an important point to make, because as I move around the country and occasionally other countries, we were just in the Middle East in October just to see for ourselves. This is a group sponsored by the Dorothy Cotton Institute, now evolving in Ithaca, New York. But people speak as though Dr. King started the movement. And I want to not so much correct that notion, but to make it clear what he actually did. Dr. King emerged out of what the people were doing, is what I like to say. This is why I emphasize the fact that Fred Shuttlesworth was already protesting the segregation of system there.
We'll talk more with Dr. Dorothy Cotton. 297-5633 is your number. Back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Dorothy Cotton is our guest. She's at LSU for events at the Manship School of Mass Communication tonight and tomorrow afternoon and tomorrow morning. And she's with us this morning. If you'd like to talk to this fabulous lady, 297-5633, a leader of the 1960s African-American Civil Rights Movement and a member of the inner circle of one of its main organizations, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Now, some folks might think the civil rights movement just went away after Dr. King died, but you're saying it has continued for 45 years after his death and is still active in American life today.
I hope so.
What has been the result of this? Would we have an African-American president if the actions that were taken in 1963 were not taken?
I doubt that. But it's very difficult, I think, to pinpoint to lift up one specific result, even though I think the election of President Barack Obama is certainly a result of a fundamental, fabulous change that happened in the country. And I'd like to talk about the fact and lift up the fact and emphasize the fact that protest activity was springing up in a lot of places. And I even emphasize the fact that Dr. King didn't start it. I really want to get, whether you ask me that or not, I want to say that he didn't start it, because it's interesting that people were protesting. We had come to a place of feeling really, really tired of being treated as though we were not citizens. And this, you mentioned the Citizenship Education Program, and that was my main job as Director of Education for SCLC. But what I want to emphasize is the fact that protest activity was springing up all over the place, and Dr. King emerged out of what the people were doing. This is, again, why I emphasize mm-hmm. that he didn't tell Rosa Parks not to go to the back of the bus, nor Fannie Lou Hamer to fight for the right of black folk to vote.
Sandra on Constitution Avenue. Good morning, Sandra. You're on with Dr. Cotton.
Jim. Good morning, Jim. And good morning, Dorothy Cotton. This is your friend Sandra. We work together in the sorority in Ithaca, New York.
How about that?
Yes. Yeah. And I have a question concerning the atmosphere today and what needs to be done. For example, we're having discussions about the Voting Rights Act. Affirmative action is under attack. There seems to be this notion that we're in a post-racial environment, and I think that it seems that we're in danger of having so many of the gains be eroded, and there doesn't seem to be the same fervent energy to prevent a rollback so that we are in a pre-1963 environment in this country. And so I just wanted to get your ideas about the kinds of things that would be necessary today to make sure that the gains that were realized in the 60s are not eroded today.
Well, what I do if I'm doing a workshop is to throw that question right back to the person who asked it. And that's what we did in the Citizenship Education Program. People don't know generally that we had a training program. And I can answer your question best by an example from one of my workshop sessions. One woman was complaining that every time she went down to City Hall, she, as an African-American woman, she would wait until the white people had been served, and then they would ask her, you know, what she wanted. And in my workshop, the Citizenship Education Program workshop, which was designed to unbrainwash black folk, in other words, we had to move away from feeling that we had to take that kind of treatment. But the third day, this woman started to tell me again how they treat black folk down there in City Hall. On the third day, I said, are you aware that you've told this workshop, and you've really even caught me when I was just walking to lunch, to tell me how they treat people, and that the city clerk treats black folks so terribly? And I asked her one day, well, why aren't you the city clerk? Now, somebody created a term called, it was a awfulizing. We can talk about how awful something is, but the reason I throw the question back to the person who asked the question is because my sense is that people have to come to a place of knowing that we the people can give life to that phrase. We the people can change things if we realize that we really are required to help make democracy real and alive in our country. We have to do it. And as long as when we ask what somebody else can do, I think we disempower ourselves. I hope there's some point in that for you.
297-5633. Thank you, Sandra. 877-217-5757, wherever you are. And Dr. Dorothy Cotton is a person who's been around for a long while fighting these battles. Did you ever get arrested?
Well, I was taken to jail, but they didn't keep me, and I know they took me to jail because I was riding in a car with the wife of Miles Horton, this blonde, blue-eyed woman, and that because we were African-American and the blonde, blue-eyed woman, I had picked her up at the station, Miles Horton, who founded the Highlander Folk School, as a matter of fact.
Which city was this?
in Tennessee. We were in Tennessee, and she, the wife was coming to do a presentation at the workshop.
So you were arrested for riding in a car with a white person?
They didn't say that, but that's the reason we were taken to jail. But they didn't keep us for some reason. I guess they realized that we might make a fuss in some way.
You might. Were you ever beaten?
Oh, yes. Actually, it's only now that I realize I'm not hearing as well on the left side, because I took some children in St. Augustine, Florida to the beach, and we had quite a powerful movement for change going on there in St. Augustine. And I took a group of children, six or seven of them, and they ran down a path to get in the water. And I went back to what I called our Freedom House. And we had quite a St. Augustine didn't get the publicity that, say, Montgomery or Birmingham got. But it was a powerful movement. There were not many press people mm-hmm. there. But we were, some children ran back to meet me when I brought a second group of children. Children, 8, 9, 10 years old. And they said, Miss Cotton, some men back there. They said, some white men back there said, they're going to beat us up if we go into that beach. You know, the beach was just for white folks. Uh-huh. And they really did beat us up. One little girl got her nose broken, and I don't hear as well in my left ear because I got beaten on this side of my head in the action in St. Augustine, Florida.
My goodness.
Yeah.
1963, June 12th, Medgar Evers was assassinated by Byra Daylight Beckwith. Do you recall that night?
Oh, yes. But it was another one of the horror stories. I don't know that I could make it any different than other people being shot and killed, except the pain of it. We had to withdraw and have moments of sort of, you know, weeping over the loss and pondering, what does this portend for us? What shall we do next? So there were always those kinds of gatherings. Our base was the church. So African-American folk, you know, we didn't have country club places to go. So there would always be meetings
in
the church.
Well, you mentioned country clubs. The most prominent country club in this community still does not allow black members. This is 2000.
It does have.
It does not.
It does not have.
No. Nope.
Right, yes. So
what do you think?
The challenge continues. And if somebody is interested in that, I don't know if they feel like they want to be somewhere where they are not wanted, African-American folks, that is. But it depends on what goal has been set. What does somebody want to do about that? I'm not sure that I would insist on being a member there. There would have to be a reason for wanting to join something where one is not wanted.
Let me ask you your impressions about a few people along the way who you probably knew. George Wallace.
Well, he was a dyed-in-the-wool racist and needed to have a transformation, as every racist does and did, a transformation in their own a sense of what is real and what is good, even though they think they are good, loving, even church-going people. But they were steeped in this philosophy. I call it American-style apartheid. And they had to be, people like George Wallace had to be shocked into realizing that we were on a roll and we were not going to stop. A transformation had occurred in black folk and our white allies. A transformation had occurred, and we were going to continue until we made we the people and the Constitution of the United States, especially, you know, the 14th Amendment, make it mean us. And that's what happened in the citizenship education workshops. Our goal was to help, especially at this point, older black folk, African-American folk, we've been called so many things, about seven different designations.
All right.
But these people had to come to a sense of knowing that things will only change if we change it.
All right. John Kennedy.
Well, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. It's a wonderful statement. I understand he didn't initiate it or bring that forward. That's one of his writers did.
His writer, Ted Sorensen, was on this show, and he said that was Kennedy's line. It wasn't
did
what
he? I'm
said.
Glad. Thank
what
you.
What he said.
Yeah, I'm really glad to learn that. But I think that it's ask not what your country can do for you, but what can you do for your country? I think that applies to the civil rights struggle, because what we did, we also did for our country, even though that was not recognized and isn't accepted in a lot of places even today. But because our country is a different country now, we changed this country because we had our American style apartheid as South Africa did.
Uh-huh. Bill Clinton.
He's a very dedicated, talented politician and citizen, activist, and with his flaws that what people don't talk about it so much now, but I prefer to look at the work he's doing in the world now and what he did then, because if we want to look at the flaws, we'd have to look at the flaws of everybody from, well, I could name some names I don't choose to name right now.
What were his flaws? Bill Clinton.
Well, I don't want to talk about his faults. I'd rather talk about the work that he does now, and I like the way he thinks. I think there is honesty there in the way he thinks, and the goals that his work is moving mm-hmm. us towards. I think it's a contribution on the planet. I've long ago given up the notion that people who do positive good work in the world are perfect specimens of humanity. I've given it up for everybody, even.
Well, I guess you're talking about the extramarital liaisons with the former president. Right?
If you want to call it a flaw, any flaw.
Well,
that
I'm
one
just
has.
Saying, his wife didn't seem to mind, so why should the rest of us?
Well, that's a very good question, and I like the fact that I remember he said he felt better when he realized that Hillary was smiling again, and I remember her saying they were really giving him, I can't use the word my grandmother would use, but she decided she was going to go over to the hearing. She said, because I love my husband, and I guess love is not predicated on whether one is a perfect specimen of husband or not. One has to decide, can I live with this flaw? And am I going to forgive it, or do I want out of this relationship? That was her personal decision, and I don't choose to. Mm-hmm. I don't choose to focus on the negative unless it gets in the way of, modeling good work and working towards positive goals in the world.
Well, as you know, Dr. King has also been criticized for that alleged flaw.
There is no human being on the planet that about which we cannot find, I'm saying this very awkwardly, what people would call a flaw. Martin Luther King did a great work in the world. We have a different country because of the leadership that Dr. King brought mm-hmm. to people struggling to change this country. I emphasize that Dr. King did not start the civil rights movement, but he came to Montgomery, Alabama with a philosophy and a commitment. He hesitated mm-hmm. at first after Rosa Parks was arrested, and they called and asked him to, will you take charge and bring us together? And if people want to lift up some flaws that they've read about or heard about, that's what they just have to do. But I don't want to spend time focusing on what is highlighted as some flaw in a person, because we dwell too much on that. Even now, there's I watch the news probably too much, but we get so much negative stuff, and never do we get seldom do we get positive things that are going on in the world.
Well, Dorothy Cotton will be at the Manship School of Mass Communication. If you'd like to hear more from her tomorrow, 9 to 11:30, there will be a forum, and then 2 to 4:30 at the Holiday Forum at the Manship School, and some others there include John Siegenthaler, former reporter and executive at the Tennessean in Nashville. He served as special assistant to Bobby Kennedy, who was attorney general during the civil rights era, and Gene Roberts and Hank Klibanoff, who won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for history for their book about media coverage of the civil rights movement. And to think you were there August 28, 1963, typing the last draft of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech?
Yes, I was certainly there.
Who ended up with the physical copy of it? I've heard stories, but actually I heard the guy who got it was a young man named George Raveling, who became a prominent basketball coach. And Dr. King just kind of left it on the podium, and he scooped it up. Can you imagine what that thing is worth? And you typed the draft, right? You felt the paper.
I can imagine what it's worth. Now people are reproducing the I Have a Dream speech.
Well, let's give it a listen, a little bit of it anyway.
Yeah, sure. Great.
I have a dream this afternoon that my four little children, will not come up in the same young days that I came up within, But they will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job. I have a dream this afternoon that the brotherhood of man will become a reality in this day. And with this faith, I will go out and carve a tunnel of hope through the mountain of despair. With this faith,
That's Dr. Martin Luther King. He died April 4th, 1968. He was only 39 years old. And a lady who knew him about as well as anybody in his inner circle, Dr. Dorothy Cotton, will be at LSU tonight and tomorrow, and we thank you for joining us today. Thank you, Dr. Cotton. It's a pleasure.
You.
An honor.
Thank you.
My pleasure. And we'll return tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.